Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to and hopefully enjoy. A bit of news. First of all, I've uploaded new versions of my novels, of my own original fiction to my website. You can find that at lukeburridge.com. Click on original fiction there, and there's new edits, slight edits of all of the fiction there, and new formats as well. So there's a PDF which is formatted for reading on an iPhone, and a PDF which is formatted for reading on an iPad, and ebook versions, and text file versions, and HTML versions, and RTF versions, whatever that is, real text file. So there's lots of different versions there. So no matter what kind of device you've got, you could probably get something that is easy to read. And also, the final book in the Minding Tomorrow series, Broken Glass, is kind of finished as a first draft, maybe a second draft kind of thing, second edit. And I'm looking for people who read Minding Tomorrow and Combat to read Broken Glass and tell me what they think of it as a third part in a trilogy or the last book in a series kind of thing as well like that. Unfortunately, I do think that Minding Tomorrow and Broken Glass are both really, really good novels, and Combat is good, but it's a very different novel from Minding Tomorrow and Broken Glass. So if you do read Minding Tomorrow and then you read Combat and think, oh, Combat wasn't as good as Minding Tomorrow, or it's different in a way, I think if you do then read Broken Glass, you could really get into it. So if you want to get in contact and check out the final book and give feedback so other people can and have a better experience, please email me luke@juggler.net. So, enough of my own life and my own ramblings. Let's get on to today's episode, which is all about The Way of Kings by Brandon Sanderson. And it is a massive brick of a book. I've got it here because I actually read it. I didn't listen to it as an audiobook or anything like that. And looking to the back, it says it is 1,250-something pages, 58 pages or something like that. 1,258 pages, and which is an impressive size for a book. And the text isn't very big either, you know. They're really going for, okay, this is an epic. So I actually don't mind, you know, checking out first books in series and then thinking, okay, if I don't enjoy it so much, I won't read on. But if I do enjoy it, hey, I can read on. I actually just made some notes here and looked through some of the books that I've done that with. So there's Game of Thrones. I checked out the first book of that, The Name of the Wind. The Lies of Locke Lamara, Mistborn, also by Brandon Sanderson. The Shadow of the Torturer, The Prince of Nothing, 100,000 Kingdoms, Spellwrite by Blake Charlton, The Blade Itself by Joe Abercrombie. So I really enjoy just dipping in and checking out the first book in a series. Now, if the series has been completed and it's good and people say it's worth reading to the end, I don't mind continuing on. But often I'll just read the first book in a series and then check out, instead of like spending time on all of that massive series, could be 12 books in the series, it could be 10 books, it could be 7 books, it could be an indeterminate number of books where nobody actually knows how long it's going to take. Instead of carrying on, I like to check out a new series and see what else I can find. Wizard of Earthsea, Shadow Magic, Steel Remains, other first book of fantasy series that I've reviewed or at least talked about on this SFBRP. So I started The Way of Kings, which is by Brandon Sanderson. I've read his two of his standalone novels, or tried to get through Elantris, couldn't. Warbreaker? I enjoyed a lot more. And Mistborn, the Final Empire, the first book in the Mistborn series, I thought was very, very strong. So I thought I would check out The Way of Kings. Now, I've heard Brandon Sanderson talking about this book on his podcast, the Writing Excuses podcast, but they don't really have a lot of time to get into it there. So when I bought it, I thought this was just the first in a series, maybe the first in a trilogy, or maybe the first of 4 books or 5 books or something like that. Then as I was into it, I didn't realize, but someone sent me a message. So I checked out on Wiki, on a Wikipedia, and it says, The Way of Kings is an epic fantasy novel by Brandon Sanderson. It is released by Tor Books on August 31st, 2010. It is the first volume in a planned 10-novel series called Stormlight Archive. I didn't realize that this was a 10-novel. It's planned to be 10 novels. It's not just like, oh, I'll get the story told in as much time as I want to. It's actually planned to be this long. Now, of course, lots of story arcs are planned. There's like the, Malazan Book of the Dead was planned to be many, many books long, and it's just come to a completion. I guess The Wheel of Time was planned to be this, you know, Song of Ice and Fire. But these are, like, it's set out, like, the author knows that when they begin this, that it won't be finished until they get, I mean, you won't even know all you need to know to understand the story properly until you get to book 7 or book 5 or something. And then things that will be revealed about those books, which makes sense of the first book in the series and cast new light on the first book in the series and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's quite a big thing to get into. And also, you know, I checked out Brandon Sanderson's website, and he says, yeah, so there's been The Lord of the Rings and The Wheel of Time and all these other stuff. This is my monstrosity. Actually, I think he actually uses the word monstrosity. This is my, entry into that big epic series, and you know, this is going to last a long time, blah 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 blah. So I actually kind of took this as a challenge. I mean, you know, any book of this size, you kind of take as a challenge. It's like, okay, go for it. This book is over 1,000 pages long. Entertain me all that time. But also, I needed to go, right, okay, you're going to do your own version of The Wheel of Time, which I've never read, by the way, not even the first book. But you're gonna try this out. Okay, go ahead, punk, prove it. You know, if you've got that in you, what are you going to, you know, you've got to impress me in some way and stuff like that. And I'll answer at the end of this novel to see if I do think this is a worthy entry into big epic fantasy. And if I do think that it'll be the first book in some classic series at the end. But yeah, it's a big chunky book. You've got to know what you're getting yourself into. So, like The Void series by Peter Hamilton, that was like 3 books of like almost 1,000 pages each or something like that. Or a book like Anathem by Neal Stephenson, or even something like Atlas Shrugged. It's a the big fucking books, and you sort of like, you know what you're getting into. So it'd be really petty of me to get into this book and read it and then go, oh, it was too long. Oh, it was a bit too slow. It was a bit too going. Oh, you know, and it's the first book of a series. So, you know, I'm not going to, you know, if I then complain about it being full of backstory and too much world building and not enough actual story and things like that, I think it would be a bit petty, because, like, you know what you're getting into with one of these books, especially if you've read other, you know, fantasy series. You know, you don't read the first book, you don't read The Fellowship of the Rings, and, you know, then at the end complain that the story hasn't finished, because it's the first book in a series. It was, you know, it would have been impossible. I mean, at the time, it was impossible to write that as a full thing. Except this is about the same size of Lord of the Rings as a book. I remember reading all of Lord of the Rings as a single volume, and that was quite a big chunky book to get through. But I think actually the text was even smaller in that book, because they have, you know, a lot of stuff to fit in. But, you know, so as a first book in the series, I'm gonna, you know, I can't really complain about that kind of stuff, but I have to hope that there's a good story in this, and to go along with all the backstory and the world building, and you know, there's gonna be lots of characters that needed to be introduced and lots of setup and things like that. I just hope that there would be a good story to go along with all that kind of stuff. So let's start off with the world, because this is what the book is really about. It's setting the scene for a big series. It's setting the scene for a 10-book series, which I didn't know when I was getting into it, but it does make a lot of sense of it. So you get the world. The world is called Russia. I'll just flick to the map at the front of this. So apparently in the east, there is a big, I think it's like a mountain or a sea. Anyway, there's a spawning point for these massive storms that nobody can get across to. Because the storms are too powerful, you just can't get there, and all that end of the world is barren, because these storms come down from this mountain, or from this, but I can't actually remember if it's just a single point where all the storms come from, but these are massive storms, they're called the High Storms, they rush across the world, propelled by magic, and all the buildings have to be built in a way that don't get them down, and the land is scoured of greenery and stuff like that, so all of the plants, and the people, and the animals, they all kind of hunker down, and the plants are kind of evolved for this kind of stuff, that the trees wrap up their branches and get them out of the way so all the leaves don't blow off, and the different plants sort of pull in their branches, and the grass digs down as well as pushes up, so they can pull its grass fronds down into the world and things like that. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on there, and it's a big place. There's lots of nations and lots of cultures, and a lot of the cultures are kind of formed by how close they are to the source of these big storms. So in Alethkar, where a lot of the action takes place, or lots of people from Alethkar, that's where a lot of the characters come from. That's very close to the unclaimed hills and the places where the storms come from. So that's all windswept, and they're a very hardy race. They're very very formal, it's very structured and things. And as you go further and further west, you get to places where, you know, the storms still blow across, but they're just like mildly strong winds. So you can still have normal grass, and instead of having these crab-like creatures that grip onto the ground and can protect themselves from storms under their little carapaces, you get chickens and horses and cows and sheep and things which can just normally, you know, they can normally live in the normal world, and that's where they can exist. So all of the, there's, so in the east, they import chickens and they import horses and things from the distant west. That's what they get from the west. But, and here's the big thing, where the storms blow, the magic is stronger, because the storms themselves kind of charge up these little beads which are used as currency, and then they can be used to perform magic. So, like, goods flow west, like agricultural goods kind of flow west, but then magic flows east. So yeah, that's the kind of thing. So the further east you go, the stronger the magic, and the further west you go, the less strong the storms, which means that more more normal cultures can exist. But like I say, I look at this map and there's lots of different countries. There's Alethka and Jarkaved and Herdaz, and there's a city called Carbranth, and on the Shinovar, which some action takes place all the way over in Shinovar, and lots of different islands and different nations spread across the place. And there's in Alethka, there's and actually all the different different countries, they have different cultures which are explored quite a lot, especially Alethka. There they have these you know, these different levels, and there's two different main levels. The aristocratic aristocracy, let me put it that way, have blue eyes or light eyes, and everyone else, the commoners and the slaves, they all have dark eyes. You get dark eyes and light eyes, and it's a very much sort of like a 90% underneath the 10%, and then at the very top you get the bright lords, which are like the 1%, and the people who have the, you know, who do all that kind of stuff. And then at the top of that you've got like the 0.0001% who have got access to old magic, which I'll talk about a bit later on. And each of these individual like the common folk are split up into, is it Dans and Vans or something like that? I can't remember the exact ways that they're split apart, but you get different levels, and right down the bottom you get slaves, and right at the top, and then down at the bottom of that, across the whole of Russia, you get the slave race, which are kind of like, they're called Pashmen, and they're very, very docile, not very intelligent, human-shaped things. But then there's the more aggressive breed of the Pashmen called the Pashendi, and they're like our non-human threatening race, like the orcs from the Lord of the Rings and the non-men from the Prince of Nothing series. They're like, oh, out there. Or maybe, I guess, like the blue eyes in what is it, the Game of Thrones, you get the blue zombies up in the north, this lingering threat out to one side. So it's very well realized, and I do think that the world building that we have here is very, very interesting, and is one of the main strengths of this. You know, you can see that Brandon Sanderson had this idea for this world in his head for years and years and years and years and years, and there's a big clunking history, and you find out, I mean, the massive parts of the book talk about like the different animals and the different culture and the different farming methods and all these different things, and that takes up probably around about a good 30 or 40% of this book is just people talking about stuff, and different characters go and draw pictures of this, and then other characters go in, we find out a lot more about that kind of stuff. But I think that's one of the strongest parts of this. However, there are some problems. For example, I said before, like, how much of this is based in magic and how much is natural evolution, and that kind of thing isn't really answered. For example, that you get the different kinds of plants that really, really hardy plants, which live up near the storm, like the nearer the source of the storm, out in Alethka and the Shattered Plains and the Frostlands and stuff like that, or if it's here. And then over in Shinovar, at the other end of the map, at the other, like in the far western face, you get like natural things which we know from our world, like, as I said, chickens and horses and grass and sheep and normal trees that just blow in the wind slightly, that don't have to, you know, contract and things. So, okay, so they still exist, which means there's still like an ecological niche for them. But then, like, I was always wondering, these plants which fold themselves up, these kremlings, these little insects which, you know, feed off of the magic dust which gets blown along with the storms, and the, what is it? I can't remember the name of them, but these sort of like, what they use is like beasts of burden, these big crab-like things, and then you get the, what do they call them? The things that they hunt as well, these big, I can't remember what they're called now. They're these big monsters, like video game bosses, you know, at the end of a video game. There's this big thing with many claws and comes out, and it's like, rawr, and it takes a long time, and you've got to beat it down. You can't just have one shot and kill it. It takes, like, you've got to shoot it with arrows, and you've got to do it. It felt very much like a video game to kill these things. But I'm like, okay, did they evolve once the storms arrived? Because if they did evolve once the storms arrived, how come all of the other, like, normal world, like, normal fantasy things like horses and sheep and humans still exist, and how does human culture still exist in this kind of thing? It's sort of adapted to the storms, but it feels like the storms, for me, it feels like the storms have only been blowing across the land for maybe 10,000 years, because there's still mountains and the wind hasn't blown the mountains down yet, and there's still, like you say, there's still lots of stuff which seems to be left over from before the storms arrived. But then I'm thinking, how much of all the kremlings and the other things which rely on the storms, how much is that a natural evolution, or how much is that just created by magic? And that wasn't answered in this book. I'm sure it will be in the following books. But there you go. So there's a good bit about world building there. Hopefully this review won't last so long, but there is a lot to talk about with such a big book. Anyway, next up, stories. The book is big. So it starts off a bit like this. I'll just go to the table of contents. So you go, you get this bump at the beginning, of course. You get, like, tour books, other books by Brendan Sanderson, and then you get a splash page, and then you get to Emily, you know, so, or for Emily, who is patient and to, you know, you get a dedication, and then you get an acknowledgement, and then you get the contents, which has got different lists and things. Then you get another splash page saying the Way of Kings, and then you get a map, which I skip over, because I never really like looking at the maps at the beginning of books. I like to read the book and then go back and look at the map and see how well the author did of laying stuff out. I mean, it's just a little challenge. I mean, it doesn't matter. I think reading the map wouldn't spoil it for you at all. But then you get the prelude to the Stormlight Archive, and you think, okay, a prelude, and it talks about something which obviously happened thousands and thousands of years in the past. And then, after the prelude, then you get Book One, The Way of Kings, and then you get another map, and you think, okay, I'll skip over there. And then you get Prologue. And I'm thinking, okay, so we've had a prelude, and then we have a prologue. So what's the difference between a prelude and a prologue? And they're like 4,500 years apart in the story, but the prologue still seems to take place. I noticed it still takes place 6 years before the main stuff that happens in the rest of the novel, once the story really picks up. And I was like, okay, so a prelude and then a prologue, and then you think, okay, the prelude is to the entire Stormlight Archive, so the prelude is like a prologue for the entire series of books. And then the prologue is like the prologue just for The Way of Kings, which is the first book in the series. And then I'm thinking, okay, so maybe this will be the only prelude, but each book from now on will have a prologue to kind of set the scene of what happened 6 years or 10 years before the events in that book, maybe. I'm not sure. So then when we actually get into it, we start off with Stormlight Archive, Book 1, Part 1, Chapter 1. And each of these parts are split up into lots of chapters. And each part, there's like four main parts. There's Part 1 to 4. And in between, we have other little short chapters, three or four short chapters called interludes. And these are from different viewpoint characters who we only ever see once each. And then one other character who always returns in the interludes that you get each time, the Sethia assassin. I'll get onto him later. And then at the end we get Part 5, which is a kind of an epilogue which wraps up all the storylines after the main conflict of Parts 1 through 4. We go back and catch up with all of our main characters again one final time, and so get the final, like, plot revelations and, like, final character things and stuff like that. And then we have an actual epilogue with a character called Hoyd, or he calls himself Hoyd, even though I'm thinking, hey, wasn't Hoyt, wasn't he the shape changer in Mistborn, I think? Anyway, so I think there's a connection. I haven't looked into it, but I think there's a connection between this book and Mistborn, although I'm not entirely sure. But the magic does feel a bit familiar in some places. So it might be set on a different planet in the Mistborn world or something in the universe. And then we have an end note, which is another kind of epilogue kind of thing, talking about the names of the parts, which I had actually worked out myself kind of already. And then we get another two appendices about some magic stuff. Oh, let me just talk about here. Part one is called Above Silence, part two, Illuminating Storms, part three, Dying, part four, Storms Illumination, and part five, The Silence Above. And I realize, oh, The Silence Above will echo Above Silence, and the Illuminating Storms will sort of mirror Storms Illumination, and then part three, Dying, will be like the middle part of the book. I'm not quite sure. It turns out that at the very end, we get this... bit here. Let me just see. It goes, as a poem, Above Silence, the Illuminating Storms, Dying Storms, Illuminating the Silence Above. And then this is actually Joshua, the head of His Majesty's Silent Gatherers. He's talking about how lots of different quotes and things like that. And this is a poem that somebody said that nobody had ever said before, but it was from like this illiterate guy, and it's a poem which reads the same forwards and backwards, and is also divisible into five distinct smaller sections. But the whole names and things which go the same forwards and backwards is kind of a theme in the book, and that's like another world building thing, which I thought was quite cool. That like a lot of the names you started reading the book, like Shallan, and it's like, oh, Shallan sounds a bit, you know, it sort of like mirrors itself down the middle, and lots of different names and countries seem to do this kind of stuff. And then about a third of the way through the book, two characters have a conversation about this very thing, and I was like, oh, I thought I was being clever there, working out this little bit of world building. I'll get onto that a little bit more. So what was I saying here? Oh yeah, and also the beginning of each chapter has, a lot of them have illustrations, which I'll talk about later, and then a lot of them have quotes, and the quotes, a lot of the quotes are, like, for example, let me see if I can find one here. How is it that I can't find? It goes, I'm cold, mother, I'm cold. Why can I hear the rain? Will it stop? And it's sort of like 30 seconds pre-death, this subject was a light-eyed female child, approximately 6 years old. And you get these things, it's like, okay, people are going around and collecting the dying words of what people say. And you're thinking, well, why are people collecting the last words of people? And it seems like a lot of these, that's quite mundane, that one, but a lot of the dying words that people say, they're quite... A woman sits and scratches out her own eyes, daughter of kings and winds, the Vandal. And it's like, oh, the subject was a beggar of some renown, known for his elegant songs, collected 73 seconds pre-death. So you got all these different things going on with this, and I'm like, wow, there's so much stuff going on in this book. And it's just big chunky stuff, and some of it's explained later on, but a lot of the stuff which is sort of like surrounding it, like I say, the order of the names of the names of the different parts of the book, all this bump before the chapters themselves. What I actually really liked about Mistborn was that the little chapter blocks, the little chapter introductions, were really clever, because they were like, in a lot of stories they tell a bit of wisdom or tell a bit of backstory, but in there they were lying, or they weren't lying, they were true, but they were misleading. So you were reading them thinking, oh I get this, and at the end of your book you're like, hey, wait a second, you can't do that. And here he's trying for something very similar. So like I say, this is just to get through this book. There is a lot of stuff here. I can't remember why I was talking about this, but let's get into some of the backstory. Thousands of years ago, blah, 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 someone left behind some magic swords and armor. Now, these swords and armor are called the Shard Plate and Shard Swords. And if you're a shard carrier, it means you have got the magic plates and the swords. And the swords are super magic, and the plates make you very, very strong and invulnerable in battle. So if you have one of these, you're awesome. And because these blah, 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 magic, blah, blah, they left them behind. So now, if you have one of these shard plate bits, and if you've got a sword, it means that that you're awesome in battle. So the Alethkar, who we spend a lot of time with, they have fought a lot, and it's sort of split apart into the 10 kingdoms, and each one of the kingdoms has one or two of the different shard plates and the swords and things like that, and they pretty much fight among themselves for territory and fight among themselves to claim the shard plate and shard swords from the other things. So that's what they do, except just before the book begins, a prince has managed to unite all the rest of them and said, hey, instead of us fighting each other all the time and killing each other all the time, why don't we get together and we can live united and we don't have to kill each other. Instead of fighting each other to death, we'll just have, different tournaments, like, you know, trying to unite the round table and all these different things. Then what happens, that sort of lasts a few years, and then an assassin is sent to kill the king, and then the Parshendi, who are our orc race, who are living over in the on the right-hand side of the map, they take credit, and so the Alethkar go, let's avenge the death of our king, and the king's son is like, yes, let's avenge the death of our king, except they surround the Parshendi and sort of force them back into what's called the Shattered Plains, which is this big broken-up plain and lots of chasms between lots of kind of islands above nothingness, and they start fighting the Parshendi, but as they're fighting, they find these big monsters that I was talking about before, and they realize that the heart of one of these monsters holds a gem that, when cut, is very, 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 very valuable. So all of these different 10 princedoms, these 10 principalities, suddenly are going, okay, we're killing the Parshendi for honor and for vengeance, to avenge the throne and to wipe out the Parshendi, actually. But really, what we can do is we're kind of mining we're trying to get all the natural resources out of the Shattered Plains. So in the end, it becomes once again just a big race, and instead of fighting each other, they fight the Parshendi, but really as a competition between the different races. So that's kind of backstory as we need to get into that kind of setting the scene. And so they stay there for like 6 or 7 years fighting the Parshendi, but not really caring about killing them all, and not really fighting each other, but kind of fighting each other, but really they're just racing to get this natural magic resource, which is, because they're so close to the storm, the magic is very potent in the area. So we get kind of four main characters throughout the book. We get Kaladin, who is in every part of the book, and he, when he was younger, he was training as a surgeon from his father, and then for various reasons he joins the army, and then he fought in a small war and something told out in flashbacks throughout the book, but now he's a slave and he's put in one of the bridge crews. And the bridge crews, like they say, there's shattered plains, lots of chasms, you've got to get your army across the bridge, across the chasms. So they have these bridges, and people have to carry the bridges and position the bridges, and then the army runs across, and then the bridge crew has to run with the bridge ahead of the army again, put the bridge down, and so then the army can cross once more. And it's okay, that's not too much trouble, but there's a reason why slaves do it and normal soldiers don't do it, is because once you get to the front, the Parshendi, the orcs, are all like kind of lined up there ahead of you, and you have to run forward with your bridge and put the bridge down ready for your Alethkar cavalry charge to go across, which means you're out in the open and you're going to get shot with arrows. So the bridge crew is really, really bad. And Kaladin, because he was a bit of an idiot while he was a slave and tried to escape a lot, he's put in with bridge crew number 4, which is generally considered the least lucky, and it's kind of a self-fulfilling like catch-22 situation, because people die very quickly in there. They put the newest recruits into bridge 4, and because they're so inexperienced, they die really quickly, so then you have to put more into bridge 4, and out of the 20 bridges, bridge 4 is the one which you really don't want to be put into. Of course, Kaladin is put into them. And so his storyline tells, because he was like a pretty good soldier in the army, and he's trained as a surgeon, he's quite well educated, he's not a light eyes, he's got dark eyes, but he was one of the highest levels of dark eyes, so he's, he knows what he's up to, he knows what's doing, and he's obviously got some magical abilities as well, because he has this little Spren, which is this little magic fairy thing which is buzzing around him all the time. So his story is him trying to reclaim his honor and take responsibility for the bridge men around him and try and train his bridge crew to be successful and try and claw their way out of obscurity without dying, or without too many of them dying. For me, this part was really, really good, because it's someone who he was quite average. There's obviously something special about him, he's obviously something magical going on with him as well, but then he's cast down and he's at the lowest of the low. He can die anytime, even though he's not gonna die. But there's a lot of, like, all the time he's running ahead and people are dying all around him, and he's trying to, you know, survive by his wits and survive by his, like, good luck. He's called Storm Blessed because there's obviously something magically lucky about him. But yeah, there's something really cool going on there on a personal level, but you sort of like care about what he does because the other people around him are relying on him, and he's trying to kind of make them rely on him sometimes, but other times gives up hope. So I really enjoyed his story. Again, I'm not going to go too much into it, but there's a lot going on there. The next group of two characters, kind of, whose stories coincide quite a lot, is a father and son team called Danilar and Adolin. Adolin the son there. And Danilar is a good prince, one of the 10 principalities. He's brother to the king who was killed, so now he's the uncle to the king, and he's getting a bit too old. But because he's the good prince, all the rest of the princes are doing things for profit or glory. He's doing things because he's read the book called The Way of the Kings, which is the book about how to be a noble king and how to be a noble prince and how to be good. So you wear your uniform at all times and don't do any dueling and lead your men and stuff like that. Don't dress up like a gay guy, all flamboyant or something like that. Don't say gay guy. Don't dress up too gaily is what I'm trying to say. Not in a homosexual way, but in a fashion sense. So that's what he's doing. And his son is younger, and he's saying, no, we shouldn't be this all the time. We should be more relaxed, and we should just be a bit more free, and we should be more, get into things a bit more, go for it, yeah, like this, let's go it, let's conquer the world, let's wipe out the things. And Danilar is a bit like, not quite sure. So it's a bit basic. He's the honourable man trying to work his way through, like, the scheming of the other princes. I've seen it done before, a bit of, like, Game of Thrones going on there. The first one, Game of Thrones, and you think he's a bit of an Eddard character, always trying to do the right thing, and people are saying, hey, don't trust that guy over there, and don't trust that guy over there, and don't trust that guy, and then he ends up trusting them, and you think, oh, come on, don't trust them. If someone's being nice to you, that's not a good enough reason to trust them with your life, especially if they're being nice to you when before they weren't being nice to you. Of course they're not, of course they're going to betray you. And so you see, it is a bit annoying. However, it wasn't as annoying as Eddard Stark, where everyone was just saying, look, if you're going to trust people, you're going to die. And then at the end, you're thinking, oh, like that. It's not quite as bad as that. But it is, like I say, a bit basic. I have seen it done before in a thing, but it is an interesting story in its own right. The next character who I really liked, who wasn't one of the three main kind of characters, but we do get back to him a lot in the interludes. He's a man from Shinnevar. He's a Shin called Zeth or Setha or something like that. And we also get him a bit in the prologue and in the epilogues as well. He's a magical assassin. He's sent to kill the king of the Alethkar. And his magic, he's got this binding magic, which when I was reading this, like, this is one of the first things that you read in the book. His instructions were clear, kill the king and be seen doing it, you know. And it, like I said before, his magic is a little bit, it's like I was just picked up reading, Mistborn Part 5 or something like that, where suddenly the world is exploding, there's a big volcano, and he's running in, and he's doing this sort of, like, magical gravity, binding things here and trapping on things there. And also, like Mistborn, the magic seemed to be very well controlled, and he was in full control of it, and there was nothing mystical about this magic. It was like a bit of science and things like that. And the way that it works is that you can change direction of gravity. It felt a bit like, hey, I'm playing Super Mario Galaxies, you know, where you can, and you jump in some ways and gravity changes. So if you jump and then you land on the ceiling and then you jump and you land on the wall, he's doing that a bit, which is cool. It's a good action sequence to get off. But I think it does start the book in a slightly different tone, because that magic isn't very well known. And then when you actually get into the other magic, you're thinking the other magic is more mysterious because it's not as well scientifically, like, categorized and advanced, and everything's worked out how stuff is going on there. So it's a bit of a weird start to the book, even though I think it would have been better told, that opening prologue would have been better told from the point of view of someone else who's like, holy fuck, what's going on here? Oh shit, I don't understand, how is this working? Rather than someone who is totally within his own mind. Anyway, Seth, I really enjoyed his character because he's this magical assassin who hates his job so much that he cries while he's doing it because he doesn't have any free will. Whoever holds a stone, which is kind of linked to his brain and his heart, and they order him to do something, he has to do it. He has no free will. So I thought the idea of an awesome assassin who is awesome at his job and is just awesome, Like, and I'm saying that awesome not as in like awesome man, but he inspires awe and fear from the other people, actually really doesn't like what he's doing and is always pitying himself and kind of blaming his victims. He's like, he's going, come on, be strong enough to fight back. I'm not allowed to kill myself. That's one of my main rules, is that I can't kill myself, and I can't give you my sword for you to kill me more easily, and I can't let myself be killed. Come on, I need to face someone who's strong enough to kill me. And of course I'm thinking, ah, well, maybe if he meets maybe if he meets Adeline, he's getting good at, you know, thing, and maybe fighting and things like that, and or Danilar or some of these other big heroic figures, or maybe Kaladin, maybe when he meets him in the second book. Spoiler: Seth doesn't meet the main characters in his first book. But you're thinking, yeah, he's being sent to kill people who are becoming too powerful. He's being sent to kill people who are having too much. You're not quite sure why he's being sent to kill people, but he's given this list. It's like, you must kill this king, this prince, this family, this prince, kill this person over here, kill that person over here. And you're just thinking, okay, well, Danilar and Adeline, or the actual king who's around now, they will be one of the targets. So Seth is probably going to meet up with them at some point over at the Shattered Plains, or wherever they're going to be in book two. Not quite sure what's going to happen in book two. Finally, we get our last main character called Shallan, and when I started reading this, I'm like, oh no, here we go. Brandon Sanderson's speciality of strong female character. I say strong, sarcastic female character, because I think that's Brandon Sanderson's way of denoting a strong, intelligent character, is just let them be sarcastic a lot. She turns up at the start of the book and goes to a city, like all of the characters in Brandon Sanderson books that I've read so far. All of the three other novels of his that I've read have a female character turning up to a city at the beginning of a book and doing stuff and finding stuff out and things like that. And so she spends most of the book kind of learning stuff. She's a bit like a librarian, because whenever we need any details, sort of like anything filling in, we skip over to her, and she can notice a small detail and draw a picture of them or read up about them or something like that. And she learns about this and about that, and there's magic and history and animals and things. There's this thing about her trying to save a family, but we pick up quite quickly that she's not really interested about saving her family from ruin, because she doesn't really like them, you know, and she's run away from her family in part to save them, but also in part just to run away from the family. She's got to swap a thing for another thing, and it's pretty clear quite early on that she probably isn't really interested in going back. She probably killed her father, I'm guessing, you know. She's running away from home. She's a compulsive liar and does all she can to wheedle away through things. She meets up with the sister of the current king, Jasnah, who knows all kinds of stuff, but she knows way more than readers and knows way more than all of the other people in the novel. And it's one of those frustrating things. It's like, well, why doesn't she just share the knowledge? Why don't we just spend some time in her head? Why are we spending time in the person's head who is one step away from her? Why don't we just learn what she's learning as she's learning it? But we don't do that. We kind of get that information doled out secondhand, which kind of makes Shallan a bit of an annoying character to spend time with, because she's disconnected from all the other action in a way which isn't really tied in at all. Like, all the other action with Kaladin and Dalinar is happening over at the Shattered Plains, and then the storyline with Seth, the assassin, is kind of leading there, and is obviously having a massive impact on the world, because he's killing all these leaders and things like that. He killed the king at the beginning, so he's definitely tied in with that story. And then Shallan and Jasnah are kind of just hanging out and doing stuff and investigating stuff, which I'm sure is going to be coming important later on, but I never thought that was going to happen. So she stays in one place. She doesn't really change very much, even though we have stuff revealed about her. And so that was, even though by the end of the novel, I kind of did like her storyline and I was interested in it, it felt a bit too disconnected. The characters, for an epic fantasy kind of thing, they don't move around very much. They stay in one place. The adventures kind of come to them. The standard quest in a fantasy book seems to be disappearing, you know, and maybe that's the influence of urban fantasy, where you just take some people, put them in a city, and then explore that city, you know, like the Potato Street Station by China Mieville. And even if I just quickly pop it back to my notes here, you know, like with Blake Charlton and Spellwright, kind of all takes place in one city. The Blade itself by Joe Abercrombie kind of all takes place in one city. The 100,000 Kingdoms, all of one city. You know, The Shadow of the Torturer, again, that's kind of all in one city. Mistborn, The Lies of Luck Lamara, so those kind of things, they all take place pretty much in one city. So I think exploring the city has kind of been done a bit too much now. So you get a bit of that with Shallan, but a lot of this takes place over at the Shattered Plains. But two of the characters travel and then arrive somewhere, and they start off the book traveling. So you know they're going to arrive somewhere, but it seemed a bit weird that, like, we get this, you know, we get this world that is built, this obviously massive world, but we don't get characters traveling through the world to see the different parts. It's not like the Hobbits start off in Hobbiton, which is this nice little kind of Victorian-style attitudes kind of place, which everyone is familiar with, and then head out into the wilds, and then go into the elf thing, and then go into the forest, and then go into the mountains, and then go... We don't get any of that. The characters pretty much stay in the same places. So to introduce the world, we get different kinds of things. First of all, we get these intermissions and we go off and we meet a character who lives over in the wet place, and we get a character who lives over on the island. We go and get spend some time with a character who lives in, who's a trader, who has traveled to this other place, to Shinnevar, and we get this other thing. Now, I actually quite liked all of these different interludes, which are nicely interluding bits of world building and characters and things. But they didn't seem to be like doing very much. Even though I liked reading them, they did seem to be a little bit tacked in. And so for the overall story, I do think the overall story does a very good job of setting the scene and setting up the characters. There is a big battle at the end of it, which I was really interested to. All the characters do kind of come together, or the four of the characters do come together. Shallan is kind of left a bit out by herself. So yeah, it's... But I quite liked all the focus. When things was actually focused on the planes, or focused on a little bit of world building and introducing, so it's novel. I mean, I say the novel bits of the novel, which are the interludes and the bit with on the shattered planes, I really enjoyed. And every time that we went back to Shallan, it kind of dragged. And it wasn't dragged because I didn't like her so much. It was kind of dragging because there was no sense of danger. I think that's maybe it, really. Like, Zeth is always doing this stuff. He hates his job. He's doing his thing. But there's always, like, he's going in and he's doing this situation. And you think, okay, he's obviously too awesome for anyone to kill. But there's sort of like danger for the people around him. You're thinking, oh, maybe this time he'll fail, and you're really kind of wanting him to fail in a way, which is this weird thing. And Caladan is messed up, and he's always caring about his crew, and he doesn't want his crew to die. You know he's probably not going to die because he's storm blessed, but there's some real trauma in his life, and there's some real there's some real danger. And Danelin as well, when if he's messing up, you're thinking, well, the kingdom is going to fall apart. And while I don't really care too much about the kingdoms falling apart, you know that thousands of people are going to die and everything's going to go bad. And maybe nobody's going to lead, and there's going to be a massacre, and other people are going to take over the king. And again, I don't really care who's king. And actually, the people who are there don't really seem to care who's king either. But you think that this entire kingdom might fall apart, and you kind of care that if he does something wrong, things are going to go really, really wrong. And of course, things do go wrong for him, and things really do go wrong for him. And with Shallan, I was like, okay, if she does something wrong, well, her family might lose its position and not have any money anymore. And you're just like, really? I don't really care about... Or if something goes wrong, Shallan might not be able to study more. And I'm thinking, really? Is that, you know, if something goes wrong, is that what's going to happen? Like, give me something like in Lord of the Rings. If something goes wrong, you know, Mordor, bum, 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 Sauron, bum, bum, bum. And here, if things go wrong for Shallan, not really sure. So, wow, fucking hell, I've gone 40 minutes already. I'm probably halfway through my notes. Okay, let's quickly get through this. Some impressions about how big this book is and how it got so big. Did it have to be this long? No, it really didn't. It's like this self-indulgent project of a best-selling author. It's up to him if he wants to pad it out. You know, he's like got his number one best-selling book in the New York Times, partly because of his own skills and also partly because he was chosen to finish off the Wheel of Time series, which I guess is obviously because of his own skills and things like that. But, you know, he actually said, look, this is my monstrosity. This is my foray into the biggest world I could possibly do. So, again, I don't mind that it's self-indulgent and that he spends a massive amount of time on world building and a massive amount of time sort of like setting up the history and all of the magic and things like that. I know getting into a book like this that there's going to be huge amounts of him setting out the magic systems and how it all works. But it did feel a little bit padded out. But even though it did feel padded out and it was long, it didn't ever feel like a slog, and I actually got through it quite quickly, mainly because I took a transatlantic flight and then was doing other flying and things like that, and then I had to wait like 7 hours in a hotel unexpectedly for a cruise ship to turn up, and I thought I was getting on. So I had a lot of time when I didn't really have anything else to do except to read it. But it's very slow in parts. You know, often the world building and the backstory got in the way of the main plot. That happened quite a lot. The main plot, while it's interesting, is only maybe 20% of the book, so that's another thing to watch out for. The rest of it is, you know, backstory, world building, and character stuff like that, it seemed like every five or six pages something came up which was either critical to the world or critical to the plot or critical to the history or the magic or critical to the religion or the characters or something like that. And like I say, every five or six pages I would read something which would make me think, oh yeah, or I'd notice something which would make me go, oh yeah, and that means this, this and this and this. And like I say, in between all those six pages you get descriptions and characters thinking and pondering and thinking and pondering, but the other things kind of slot together. And then later on in the book, those in between the every five or six page, one or two of the pages will be going over stuff that you've already worked out, which made the beginning part of the book so interesting or so dynamic when you're actually getting all of these little hints, which is really strange because by then I was like, yeah, no, I understand that. No, I picked this up before. But that was strange because that made me feel intelligent for working it all out before characters actually explain it to each other or before the narrator explains it to us, the readers. But then I did think those bits later on were annoying and a bit redundant, or very redundant in some cases. Very redundant. But then in between those redundant parts, I was still getting every five or six pages more revelations about the plot, more revelations about characters, more revelations about the world and things like that. So it does all slot together. So like I say, we got all these parts. Kaladin. Oh yeah, here's another thing which made the middle part of it drag a bit, because part one we get Kaladin and Shallan, part two we get Kaladin again, but then Adalyn and Dalinar, and that was great because suddenly we didn't have Shallan anymore and I was sort of more interested in Adalyn and Dalinar. And then the next part three, we get Kaladin, he's in every part, but then we get Shallan again and then we don't get Adalyn and Dalinar. And I was like, oh, I was really enjoying these bits. What are they doing now? And that's where it really, part three kind of really dragged a bit for me because we spent so much time with Shallan. But then, strangely enough, we go back to Kaladin and Adalyn and Dalinar, and then there's no Shallan anymore. And at that point, I was like, oh, no, now I'm more interested in this. So why are we going these massive parts of the book where we don't get any of the characters? Not that we enjoy, but like their stories must be still continuing. But now we're going weeks and weeks with this other character. So what are these other characters that we spent all that time with? What are they doing in these weeks? So that's a bit tricky. So what note here? Oh, yeah, an edited version. I think what you could do is that, sure, everything in this book, it doesn't need to be there, but like I say, every five or six pages you're getting something which is kind of crucial, you're getting something which is kind of important. And I wish that what they'd have done is taken out the important stuff from Shallan, because often the important stuff with her is that we switch back to her and she draws a picture of something and you're like, oh, that's important. Or we switch back to her and it's like, oh, you're gonna, oh, right, I see. You switch back to her and it's like, oh, and there's this character and this character and this character, which is important for the other stories. And I kind of didn't like that, because what I really wanted to do is have a book where we didn't have any of Shallan and we just concentrated just on the things that were happening over there on the Shattered Plains. And I think that would have been a better way to start off a big series of just go, okay, everything that's going to happen is going to happen within 100 miles or within one character of this person. So if we're going to switch across to an epilogue, it has to happen to somebody which is directly, like Seth, this assassin who has been hanging around. He killed the king at the beginning. What's he still doing now? You know, why don't we should really get a character like that and cut out all the rest of this. There's, like you say, the prelude that we get at the beginning is repeated in a dream sequence later on. Chapter one, once we get past the prologue, chapter one is told from the point of view of a kid who dies. And we know he dies because as soon as we get to Kaladin, he said, oh, all my entire squad died, and he was one of Kaladin's squad. And then we get that same chapter, that same part of the story told from Kaladin's point of view later on, which is totally redundant. Part five in the epilogue, maybe part five, some of it could be included just into the end of part four. The epilogue should be taken out, and that should be used as the prologue for the next book. Take out all the Shallan parts, like I say, you know, it illuminates stuff elsewhere. But Shallan's story is interesting enough, but it doesn't fit. That could just be a standalone novella. Actually, it's probably enough in there to fill a whole novel, but that could have just been like included in the second book, or just as a side book, a side project, you know. And then take out all the times when the characters are thinking the same thing over and over and over and over and over again. That would probably shorten the book by around about 20% or 30%. Kaladin doesn't want any to die. We get it. Stop telling us what he's thinking about. And Dalinar wants to do the right thing. Okay, we get it. Shallan isn't sure if she should steal the thingy and save her family. We get it. Why do we have to spend pages and pages of them like quandering? Just get them to decide something. Have something happen. You know, character moments are best when they do something, not when they think something. thing. And a lot of this, the character motions and character movements and character, all that kind of stuff, seems to be lots of people thinking about stuff. Fuck, I'm almost 50 minutes in. I've still got lots of notes to go. Let's see if I can get through this quickly. So, characters. Yeah, I sort of mentioned this before. I've talked about the main characters and what I liked about them. We do spend a bit of too much time in their heads, but they are set up pretty well. Not massively three-dimensional, but two dimensions is good enough, as long as they're not totally one-dimensional. All of them have something, and then something conflicting with that something, which I think is kind of like the definition of a two-dimensional character. If you just got one thing that's driving the character with no conflict within them, I think that's kind of the definition of a one-dimensional character. Unfortunately, all of the minor characters, for a book this big, I was expecting a little bit more for them. I really did want a bit more, two-dimensionality from them. Like, we got names and we know where they're from. It's totally racist, this book, because all of the people he meets, like all of the slaves in Bridge Crew number 4, are just tokens of their countries, to kind of involve their countries and to kind of visit their countries and find out a bit about their religion or find out a bit about their society or their, you know, the structure of, you know, status in their countries without actually having to visit them. And yeah, so we get quite a lot of that. But apart from their nationality and apart from their size, they're not really anything. It's sort of like, this guy was a big man who was good with a plow. This man was a big man who could cook. You know, and sure, you can't just listing attributes of someone doesn't create a three-dimensional character. They have to want something and then something has to go against them. They have to want two different things. They have to have two aspects of their life which are in conflict to get a two-dimensional or three-dimensional character. Just listing lots of attributes that they look like this and they do that doesn't make for interesting characters. And then, like, a lot of the characters just aren't there at all. We spend one scene out of a 1,258 page book, we spend one scene with Caladan with other people who aren't his brother, the sickly child of a brother, or not his father. You know, that's it. All of the rest of the time, he's just like a single guy floating around, disconnected from everyone except his father. And that doesn't make for interesting character. I mean, the stuff that goes on between him and his father is interesting, but that could have, in a way, all been told from his father's point of view. Or cut out the stuff from his father's point of view and tell all of it from his point of view. And I think it would have found a lot more depth there, because then you could have had him spending more time with other people, not his father, and him spending more time doing things which weren't all about his father. But we're told he keeps himself distant from people. I made a note here, but it seemed like a bit of an excuse at the time. It's like, oh, I don't hang around with that many people. I don't get to know that many people. And it seemed like, it just seems like Brandon Sanderson doesn't want to introduce too many more characters. Another note. Yeah, we spend a lot of time in the heads of our main characters. This is, I guess, my main complaint about the character development. And here's another bit. Problem with developing... Oh, man, this is going to be such a long episode. Problem with developing characters by filling in backstory via flashbacks. The backstory and the secrets revealed has to lead up to the person who they are at that moment, which is a big problem that I had with the books by Richard Morgan, Market Forces in particular, that there's this mysterious thing that goes on in his backstory, and then we have the full backstory playing out, you know, in front of us, although he doesn't do it by flashbacks. He just has characters saying, oh, and this happened in my past, and that happened in my past. But he fills in the backstory. However, the backstory in Market Forces filled in his character up until the character he was at the beginning of the book, not at the end of the book. And we have the same problem here with Caladan. We get lots and lots of backstory that are filling up his... Unlike Chasm City, where once we find out all the backstory parts of our Tana Mirabel, it really does make a big difference. We hit all his backstory that gets filled in, and all the backstory that happens fills in his character at the end of the novel, certainly not at the beginning of the novel. And here's the opposite. Caladan, we kind of know who he is at the beginning of the novel in Chapter 1. We find out via this sort of like this external viewpoint that he cares for his men, that he doesn't want anyone to die, that he's a good soldier, that he was trained as a surgeon as a child, but then joined the army. And then we find out that he joined the army to protect his brother, but failed. But then we find out through flashbacks that he joined up to the army to protect his brother and failed, and that he was a good soldier and a good leader. And we find out via flashbacks that he was trained as a surgeon while he was young, and that he has resentment towards the dukes and the princes because of this, and that the duke betrayed him because of that. But we know all of that through his character interactions and talking about people and his thoughts as we go through the main story. And pretty much all of the backstory could have been filled in just by him mentioning it to somebody, but So when we actually do get to the end of the flashback backstory bits, we haven't actually learnt very much new. All we've learnt are some minor details of how the incidents played out. And in the end, those details aren't important for his character at the end of the novel. They're only important for his character at the beginning of the novel. So if I was going to edit this, you could probably make three really, really good novels about this. You know, take Shallan's story, tell that separately. Take Kaladin's backstory and tell that up until the point he arrives at the Shattered Plains, and then pick up the story at the Shattered Plains with Kaladin and Dalinar and the other kind of stuff, and use Seth to kind of fill in the bits in between. So getting on here. Oh man, here we go. Longest episode ever. Magic. There is a lot of magic in this book. Thankfully, there is a good balance between magic, which is wondrous and brand new, and nobody knows how it works. Which is good, and I think I mentioned this in the Zoo City thing. It's sort of like magic has to be mysterious in some ways, otherwise it's just feels like technology and it's not wondrous to anyone. But in the same time, magic, if you're living in a world of magic, people do know how to do some magic, so there is a good mix in this book. So like I say, bindings, when you could do a storm binding or a soul binding or whatever it's called there, and you can make gravity change and stick things to walls, that's great. That's what Seth uses. He's a wind walker or something like that. Sounds a bit like a Zelda game, but yeah, okay, Windwalker, and so there's that kind of stuff, like say, right out of Mistborn, but then you get this other stuff, like the shards and the blades, which is all tied in with the religion and the Almighty, and the backstory with the Radiance and the Knight's Radiance and the apocalyptic kind of stuff, and you realize that, yes, of course, the magic shard plane to which is the armor, which makes you more powerful, and the swords, which can cut through rock, you know, because they were built to defeat enemies which are made out of rock. These big kind of golem characters, but like big giant things. Okay, they're going to do that kind of stuff. So you get all that kind of... And that's tied in with religion. And then you get this other kind of thing, which is soul casting, which if you have this certain glove, you can use the gems which are infused with power from the storms, and the storm in infuses that, and then you can spend that by, and you can make things, you can repair the shards and the blades, but also you can create new magic things, and you can turn rocks into food, which is how they feed all of the armies, and you can repair this, and you can make something out of wood and then change the wood into metal, and that's how you make things out of metal, you know. So that's all really interesting as well. But then there's the more mysterious things, like these things called spren, which are these little sprites, these little things, these little flame-like being kind of things which spring in and out of existence when something happens or when something changes or when something appears or when something disappears and all that kind of stuff. And then you get there's this oracle that is mentioned who can grant a wish but also gives a curse at the same time, and I thought that was quite interesting. And there was this one point where you're like, oh, I understand now why this character is doing this, or why this character has this little character thing. Oh, it's because they went to see the oracle. And you kind of work that out halfway through the book, and then three quarters of the way through the book, two characters have a conversation. It's like, oh yes, and I have this because I went to the oracle. And I was like, oh, come on. And that's not really a spoiler, but there's all those things. And again, this is what made the book so interesting, is that I kept on constantly thinking that I was working things out myself ahead of where I should be, and then later on Brandon Sanderson is continuously filling you in on these details, and it happens with the magic. You're like, oh okay, the magic is going to be like this, and I was thinking, oh, this magic is a bit like Mistborn, and then a character called Hoid turns up, and I'm like, I didn't understand. I mean, if you've not read Mistborn, Hoid, I'm sure in the later Mistborn books Hoid comes, you know, is maybe a bit more, I can't actually remember which character is from Mistborn, but I know he's there, and I'm like, oh okay, so you work that out. And then you get this things with the Fabrials, and you're like, oh, I understand what this is. It's sort of like this magic device, and I understand what's going to go on here. And you kind of work that out three quarters of the way through, and then at the end of the book you're told, oh yeah, you were right. And so that, I think that's maybe why it's a satisfying book, because you're kind of piecing things together, and then you don't have to, it doesn't stay mysterious for you. However, it does have this big problem. Why are people only investigating spren now? A spren get changing or something like that, and suddenly people are working stuff out about spren, which they're not. And again, it makes me think, if this magic has always been there, why haven't people been studying it before? And why is the studying, why are the answers to this and how the spren works, why is it only being discovered now when it's going to play into the plot? That seemed a bit annoying. Okay, so an hour into this, I've only just got to the writing. I think I'm going to just get to the end of the writing and maybe talk about the artwork. I'm going to skip over the themes, maybe one word here. But there is stuff to say about this. So it's a very easy read. Sanderson, like on a sentence level, is pretty good. And you're never really confused with what he means by any line, which is, it does happen quite a bit with writing. You read a line and go, oh, okay, there's something a bit, you know, something a bit strange there. But Sanderson, he does do it, even if it's a bit kind of basic. You kind of think, oh, am I reading a young adult novel here? Because there's not very much complexity there. But in a way, when the book is so complex and the plotting is going to be complex and the world is complex, just having things described in like normal basic English is quite easy. Sometimes the characters say something or do something, or the language used is a bit too modern. I can't think. I mean, it wasn't as bad as, oh, I'm going to go to the ladies' room, kind of modern. But, you know, that really took me out of a book. What is it, The 100,000 Kingdoms, when a character says, oh, man, I'm going to go to the ladies' room. And you just think, wait a second, is this a fantasy book or is it set in, like, you know, the modern day? And while some of the language was a bit too modern, it didn't take me out of the book, even though I didn't notice it. It's very well edited as well. Because often in books I'll read through and there'll be spelling mistakes and editing mistakes and repeated words and things like that. I found one mistake in this book, and this, I mean, I'm sure it's the paperbacks, they've caught a lot of the things and done a lot of things, but of a book which is like 1,258 pages long, finding what, and noticing, maybe there was more, but I only noticed one error in the language in the book, and I can't even remember what it was now, so I think that's pretty fucking good. The action in the book, there's good action at the beginning, there's a lull in the middle, but the battle at the end, it goes on for like 70 pages. Now, often in these big fantasy books, sometimes you think, oh, the battle at the end is just, it's just gonna play stuff out. So everything's in place, and now you're just gonna have a battle. And if you'd have just written, there was a big battle and these guys won, you'd probably get the same amount. But thankfully, at the end of this, it's a culmination of lots of different character moments. Not Shallon, because she's not around there, but all of the other characters do stuff and find their own way and get what they want or don't get what they want. And there's the, you know, again, I don't want to give too much away, but it does really work out. So at every moment in this 70, 80 page battle at the end, I was interested and excited of going, of seeing what was going to go on. You kind of knew what was going on. It was telegraphed in advance, but it was very satisfying. All the action was good, and at any one point you're thinking, okay, this person might die now. I was actually thinking, you know, Danilar, that, you know, I'm not going to say if he dies or not. It's not like Ned Stark, where you're just thinking, well, you're gonna die, you're in a position, there's no way out. But here you're always like, you might die, that you might get out of it. And then I'm thinking, oh, but then there's Adolin, his son, as well. Maybe he's gonna give up his life for his father, or give his life, or do something like that. And you're all the way time you're thinking, oh, so I don't want to give away who does die at the end. People do die at the end, but yeah, it really does keep you on the edge of your seat, and that's quite impressive for like a 70 page battle sequence. So it is very stuff. Yeah. What else here? Oh yeah, clever stuff with the names and titles. Oh yeah, I mentioned that before. You kind of feel clever. I can skip over that note. Random capitalization of things. Really, really not good. It really takes away the mystery. If you mention something, like, for example, this is just one example from it. Shallon is a very good artist, and the reason she's a good artist, because if she looks at something, kind of blinks, or she takes a memory, she like captures a moment, an eye blink, even though, you know, it's not a physical blink, but it's like a moment in time, she captures it, and then she can draw it with kind of some kind of magical drawing ability. So she can do that, and it, and that works out really nicely. But that, she says she captured a memory of it. And it says it quite like, and the memory, she takes a memory of something. It's like she's taking a photo. Now, if you take a photo, you don't capitalize photo. It's just you taking a photo. So if it's mundane that she can take a memory of something, and she does it quite often, for her, it's pretty normal. But it doesn't seem like anyone else can do this, so it's like it's not explained. So the capitalization of random important things, like the storm, it's a storm, and it's a the prince, and it's a capital P for the prince, and this, and it's the shard, which is a capital S for the shard. It gives things importance which the characters themselves shouldn't find important, but then do find important because they've got a capital letter, but they don't say, they're not seeing the capital letter. The men in the book can't even write. They're not allowed to write. You know, only the females write. So the capitalization of things does seem to be totally fake. And again, if it's new and mysterious, don't explain it away with a single word. And if it's not new and it's not mysterious, it doesn't need to be capitalized unless you're German. And finally, oh yeah, I mentioned the Spren before. Now, here's a big problem with descriptions. I don't mind long descriptions of stuff. That's great. But if something's important, like the Spren, obviously, you can see it being set up. Nothing is explained in this book, you see, but these are going to become massively important as the series goes on. But there's Spren all over the place. And the Spren. You get Water Spren, and you get Rot Spren. Anytime something appears or changes in any way, you get some Spren. And so anytime you have you get Sing Sprens. If you start singing, Sprens spring up and come around. And I'm like, okay, I'm a bit sick of Sprens. Like, I think there should be a Luke is getting sick of Spren. Because Sprens, it's like Love Spren, and Fear Spren, and Joy Spren, and Anticipation Spren, and Glory Spren. I'm like, you gotta tell me what these are. I know they're little flame-like beings which flicker around, and they appear and disappear, and they're obviously a connection, and that's all the way that magic works. Obviously what comes through these things, you know, it's gonna be weird. But, like, I don't know what the difference is between the different Sprens. What does a wind Spren look like compared to a fear Spren? If fear Spren pop up, how do I know that it's not a fear Spren and not a joy Spren and not a anticipation Spren, but actually a agony Spren or a pain Spren? Like, the narrator knows what they are and says, oh, this is a pain Spren, and this is a joy Spren. And the characters seem to know the difference between the different Sprens. But as a reader, I'm kind of stuck. I don't know what the Sprens are. Some of the Sprens that described it are like, oh, and this is a mysterious Spren. Nobody knows what this does, and it looks like this. I'm like, yeah, but what were the difference between the different Sprens? How can I tell? It's really annoying. Sprens. Fucking hell. Moving on. I made a note about swearing. One word, swearing. I hate it in a book where the swearing takes me out of the book. Again, talking about Battlestar Galactica, frack this. Is it frack? Yeah, fracking this. And in Red Dwarf, although that doesn't really fit this. You can't just make up a swear word and have it be offensive to the people in the novel. I guess you can do that. Maybe frack is a good one that you know, everyone knows what frack is standing in for. It's just a way of getting past network television censorship or, you know, ratings and things like that. So that works. That's just a one-for-one substitution of an unknown word, like a random word for another one. However, swearing has to be effective to the people around them, and the way that swearing is effective is that it has to be forbidden within the situation that it's being said. Which is why if people are used to swearing, the swear word disappears, because if people are just saying fuck all the time, fuck loses its impact. And that's what happens. You know, you hear people talking all the time and they're just using fuck in the same way that I'd use it's like, oh, and I was fucking doing this. You know, it's not even swearing anymore. It's just a language crutch. It has no meaning anymore. So the way that it has to have meaning is that it has to be forbidden or out of context or in that normal social situation. It has to be shocking in some way. And so you have to tie the concept of a swear word to something which is out of place in the current social situation. It has to either be of a higher status or a lower status. And it has to be, you know, so it has to be either shameful or it has to be holy. It has to be sacred. Like, sacred means, like, if I say... Jesus Christ. You know, I'm saying that out of context because Jesus Christ isn't here and I'm not in church and I'm taking the Lord's name in vain. Oh God, you know, Holy Mother of Christ, you know, that kind of stuff. If I was in a church and I went, Jesus Christ, you know, people wouldn't think he's swearing. They'd think he's praising God. And the reason that you're using God's name out of the church, out of a religious circumstance, not at the beginning of a prayer or at the end of the prayer or hallowed be thy name and stuff like that, it becomes a swear word. It's the same with scatological swearing. Shit, crap, piss, load of piss, what a load of, you know, turd, you, all that kind of stuff, piss off, that kind of thing. That's okay, but if you need a shit and say, oh, stop the car, I need a shit, that's not swearing. That's a description. It might be crude language, but it's not a swear word. Crude language and the vernacular doesn't mean a swear word. That's not swearing is. Swearing at that point is just a description. And it's the same thing with sexual stuff as well. Fuck you, you dickwad. Don't be a pussy. That's all kind. But in the right context, those words are not, you know, are not swearing. Like during sex, saying some sexy words can actually be quite hot. I was actually once juggling, and I did a juggling show at a trade show, and it was a urology conference, and everybody there was walking around, and there was massive pictures. I was actually performing in front of a massive screen which showed someone's penis. It's like a diagram, like an animation of a penis with a penile erectile implant in it, and someone was pumping a thing, and a penis was getting erect and getting flaccid behind me, kind of on a loop of an info thing, and this was taking place behind me. The next day I went back and performed, and there was a leg spread shot of a vagina with people like sewing up, doing like vaginal surgery with scalpels and sewing and sticking in pipes and stuff like that. For me, that was like the most horrific gig that I've ever done, because all of the time, all of this stuff, everybody at that conference didn't give a shit about it, because, or didn't give a fuck, you know, or whatever I'm trying to say here, is because for them it was just in context. And of course you can mix these all together. You can go stuff like, holy fucking mother of God who shits on the face of Jesus. That's offensive. I mean, now it's not, because I'm talking about swearing, and it's difficult to talk about swearing and try and be offensive and stuff. It's difficult to do this, but you can mix it together, and by mixing it together, you can go like, oh, do bears shit in the woods? And then you go, does the Pope shit in the woods? It becomes funnier because I'm bringing religious and holy and mixing it with the crude scatological to make more, and I'm sort of combining the higher sacred with the lower scatological. Again, maybe I think about swearing a bit too much. But when it comes back to this book, it's really difficult to think that the people are swearing. It's not just a word substitution. They say storm instead of fuck or piss or shit or anything like that. They use the word storm. And that's wrong. That's not a swear word. It's not like frack or smeg where they're just substituting a word. If you do that, if you just make up a new swear word and substitute it, that's great. That's no problem at all. But storms are powerful and not hidden, and they're not revered. They're dangerous, but they're out there. They sweep across the country every 4 or 5 days. They're regular. There's nothing, I mean, sure, they're magical and they're powerful, but there's nothing holy about them which makes them only to be discussed in a certain context, and there's nothing crude about them to make them only be discussed in a certain social context. They're everywhere. It would be like me saying, while working on a cruise ship, saying, cruise ship you, or like in a normal world, house you, or automobile, or food, or something like that. You can't just substitute something which is common. Even if it's powerful, it doesn't make a swear word. People don't use political nomenclature as swear words that can be insults. Insults are great. You know, you can call someone a pinky or a lefty or something like that. But nobody just comes out and says, ah, Republican. Because it doesn't mean anything. It's not it's everyday language. It's not offensive. It's there. It's not sacred. But if you know, there's other things that you could say. Like I say, it's difficult to come up with things which aren't in our world, like, you know, aren't scatological or sexual or religious and things like that. But I was reading this book and I'm thinking, storm is such a shit word. There's so much other stuff. The insults and the swearing that they could have done here, or Brandon Sanderson could have picked, would have been such a much more important or much more world-buildery thing to do. For example, I talk about you know, the Almighty and all that kind of stuff, and there's a Vorin religion. Why aren't the swear words tied in with that? Why aren't people saying, you know, go fuck Vorin, or go jack of Vorin with your left hand? Oh yeah, that's another thing. So left-handedness, or not left-handed, women in society keep their left hand covered in the Alethkar society, and the males don't read. That's kind of their like defining male and female different characteristics in a totally, utterly sexist kind of way, but whatever. So women keep their left hand covered all the time and only use their right hand in polite society. So why don't, and men don't read. They're not allowed to read. They can read these glyphs, which are like pictures of, you know, I'm thinking more kind of like very basic level Egyptian hieroglyphs, where if it looks like a tree, you say the word tree, and then if it looks like a badger, you say the word badger, and tree badger sounds a bit like tribadge, which could be a nation or something like that. You know, you can sort of understand glyphs on a very basic level, and, you know, understand basic counting, I'm guessing. I think those are the two weakest parts of the world building, the men not being able to read, and the women not covering their left hand. But why not use these as swear words? Instead of saying storm off, why don't you say go read a book, like to a man? A man saying go read a book to another man would have been a good, instead of saying storm off, which doesn't mean anything, you could, or go, I don't know, do something with your left hand. Go do something rude with your left hand. Or the soul casters as well, like go soul cast yourself a new hat and shove it up your ass, or, you know, mixing them, you go soul cast some Pashandi shit and rub it in your eyes until your eyes aren't white, they're brown. You know, that kind of thing. Really use the different social standings of people to insult them in different ways. And finally, storm off is a bad word, a bad way of, like, storm is a bad swear word, because if you say storm off, that actually means something in English. To storm off means to get into a huff and stamp away, going, oh, fuck you, this. That's what storming off means. So if you tell someone to storm off, in grammar-wise, that would be, I don't know, if you actually tell someone, I can't even remember the grammar way of doing this, but it's, I can't remember what it is. But when you tell someone to do something, it's a command, like, do this. You are the subject, and this this action that I'm telling you to do is what you should be doing, and you are the subject, so you should do it. It's like, do not put litter in a bin. I can't remember the grammar term for this. Anyway, but you are the subject, and you should not be doing this, or always do this. Stop. Go. You're the subject, and you have to do it. So when you say storm off, it doesn't mean fuck off. It means go away angrily. But that's not what you're wanting to do. You're wanting to just go off, fuck off, piss off. That's what you want, isn't it? Storm you as well. So if you say storm you, doesn't mean the same as fuck you, because storming something is like you're an army and you're going to storm a stronghold. Storm you, if you say it to a castle, means not a swear word. So yeah, anyway, I was very annoyed by the... it wasn't annoyed, but it was like such a missed opportunity. Maybe I'm a bit too passionate about swearing and things like that. But and then there's a character called Wit, who his job is, of course, to insult people. He is the king's fool, and he has to insult everyone. And there's like one insult which comes up, which is actually, I actually found crude and surprising and insulting in a way, which wasn't just like half-hearted, like, oh, you're really not very intelligent, are you? No, you're not. Oh, you look a bit stupid today with your clothes. Oh, like this. Most of them were like that. But there was this one thing that he says, which was like, you're calling me, you say I should be making insults. Okay, I'll stick, you know, my job is to make insults and your job is to be in sluts. And just the insults in sluts line came as so shocking, it was so out of place that it was actually shocking. It was actually a good insult, it was actually a good swear word. And I was like, oh, why don't we have all of this? Why don't you make Wit, like, clever, but in a way where he is just totally, utterly devastating, not just to the person's looks or personality or abilities or something like that, just really rips into them from a societal world-building point of view, not just a, oh, I bet your penis is small. Like, if you would have actually said, your penis is as small as a Pashendi thing, I don't even know, because I don't know as well. It's not my world to do. Fine, I'll just quickly talk about the artwork. At the beginning of the book, we get this, the contents actually says illustrations. You got the map of Russia, the map of the Unclean Hills, Shallon's sketchbook Sky Eels, a map of the lumberyard. You know, so you're getting these different sketches and maps all the way through, and a lot of them are really interesting, actually. And they do add a lot. For example, that you see a little thing, and it's a little picture of a tree, or a shell, or something that Shallon is sketching in the real world, and then it's mentioned, like, in that chapter, or mentioned a few chapters later, and you're always like, oh, I wonder how this is. So I really, really enjoyed the way that the artwork played into the book. It did give a lot. Some of the maps were a bit weird, because I was like, is this in scale? You know, map of the war camps, and it actually says, oh, this is probably not to scale. An idealized version of this, and you're like, oh, okay, that's good. But two different things that stood out with the art style. First of all, Shallon has this this ability of catching a memory and then having it, and then she just draws without even looking, and she just draws, and everything just comes out, no problem at all. But then the sketches, which are from her sketchbook, from her point of view, they I really like the artwork, but they don't really fit with her style, because she should be drawing something... just look here, there's a picture of an axe hound, and she makes these lots of little sketches, like studies, like you would, like with the more scribbly lines, without it being inked in or whatever the kind of thing that you need to say, like when you get like a very rough sketch and then you make it into the final version, which is something that could actually be used as a real illustration with all the details in. I'm thinking, if she's got this memory thing that she can just capture a memory and then just draw it without any problem, why is she doing lots of little sketches like this? Why didn't she just take a picture and then just draw the final thing? So that was one little thing about the artwork which sort of stood out, even though the artwork itself I thought was really nice. It just as a plot point was a bit weird. Then another thing is that sometimes you get these historic things like, oh, this is a page from this book which is explaining this from the Book of Kings, and some of them, the artwork didn't look too modern. It looked very much like late 20th century cartoon style kind of front cover of a fantasy book kind of art, which took it out of a bit. And so that was another thing which I thought was a little bit missed. And what else do we have here? I'm just looking through. Oh, yeah. Another thing that's cool is that one thing that was a bit strange, that the chapter headings have all got these like archways, which look like these wooden carved archways. And they all have a number on them, 41, and of Olds and Milp. And that's the name of the chapter. And the contrast is so light that I actually got about 7 or 8, maybe 10, 20 chapters in or something like that, and only then did I realise that there was actually some writing on them, because the writing sort of disappears into it in a way which means that I just didn't even see the writing. But what I do like about the chapters, underneath the archways, you know which character you're with, because Adeline always has like a shield with a crown on it and things like that. Caladin always has these spears sticking up past a crescent moon with a flag flying from it. And I think the flag changes from chapter to chapter. Let me just look here. Yeah, I think it does. In the 5.5 years ago, in his flashback chapters, he's in a different place. So I think the flag changes, although that might be my imagination. And if we find Shallan... I can't find one here. Nope, that's another one. I can't find Shallan. I've forgotten what Shallan's was now, but she has a different one. Oh, I can't find one of her chapters. Sorry about that. But she also has her own kind of thing at the beginning. Nope, still can't find it. Nope, still not there. Nope, still can't. What? Is there? Oh no, I'm in the middle part of the book where she disappears. Oh, fuck. No wonder I couldn't find it. Anyway, so yeah, she has different things too. I'm going to find it. I don't know why I'm so obsessed about this now, but I've got to find fucking hell. Oh yeah, she's got like this little bead with a sunset in it. That wasn't even worth getting to in the end. Fucking hell, an hour and 20 minutes. Artwork, good. Finally, the themes. It's a bit difficult to go into this because it's such a big book, and it's all totally on the surface because the characters are constantly thinking about what they're talking about and stuff like that. It's like honor, you know, I'm going to be honorable and I'm going to be the good guy, and let's Caladin and Dalinar and all that kind of stuff. You're like, yeah, like this. This is why I liked Shallan's story. If it was been its own story, it would have been more interesting because she actually did think about stuff and she was having discussions about philosophy and things, but again, it was all totally on the surface. It's like, if you're going to have a discussion about different philosophies, why are you just having a discussion about it? Why don't you just write this as an appendix, or why don't you just have like it's a bit strange. It's like in the middle of 1984, they're going to go, okay, and now I'll just read from this book, and you just skip into a book and just read that book for a while and then go back to the main characters again. And I always think that kind of thing is the weakest part of the book, and here it's so much on the surface in some ways. Of course, there's a lot about guilt and history, which is a bit heavy-handed. I do think the themes that Sanderson is trying to explore here is a bit clunky. But there's a thing that kind of pop up within his fiction, like, unintentionally. Like I said before, the sexism in this book is just, oh, it's unbelievable. And you think, okay, he's writing a secondary world. He can write this as it is. But it can't, like, every book that he writes, the females are different from the men. The men have the power and the females have other powers, but not real powers, not political powers. And then when they do have political powers, it has to be snide. And then at the end, the men have the power and the men come out on top. And it might be because Brandon Sanderson is a Mormon. I know he's got this big fascination with, you know, the religion, all that kind of stuff. Of course, it's going to come through. His religion is going to come through. But there is a huge, for me, a big part of the books seem to be just how different men are from women. They've got different stations in life. And the women aren't even repressed, which makes it even more annoying. Like, in the Prince of Nothing series, the women are just totally second-class citizens. And then, as you read through the books, you realise, oh, actually, they can be more powerful than men. And that's why I see why men are sort of beating them down and making them more repressed. And the story is going to be, like, you see the story of women kind of coming across that. But here, like, the women kind of, they read and write, and they're the historians, and they do that kind of stuff, and they do stuff, and they're powerful. But I don't understand why. It just seems a bit strange, like, to say, oh, it's okay, I'm not being sexist, women are just as important as men, and women just like this. But it, like, when the entirety of their character comes down to their entire function in the book, it totally revolves, utterly revolves around their not just their gender, but their, you know, also their sexuality in a way, although that doesn't come into play in this book at all. It does feel just like he's missing a trick here. Like, if you're going to have a world where everyone is equal, great. If you're going to have a world where nobody is equal, great. And it seems like he's playing with and failing at the notion that women are equal than men, but just totally, utterly different in a way which is just unquestionable. It's like the unquestionable basis of all of his fiction that I've read so far is that women wear dresses, men have swords. Women are clever, intelligent, and sarcastic, and strong, and men are a bit stupid, but honourable, and all that kind of stuff. And women are clever at this, and more, you know, powerful with magic and stuff like that, but men are, you know, clunking, and you know, it's just a bit weird. Like, there's never even the acknowledgement that, hey, wait a second, if a man in one of these books learned to read, how awesome would that be? Oh, and if a woman wanted to become, like, not just really, really, really clever, how would that turn out? And maybe it'll be explored in this series of novels, but so far, in four novels that I've read by Brandon Sanderson, the sexism, while I understand he's trying not to be sexist and he doesn't want repressed females, the repression, the boxes that he puts people into, men as well as women, as well as different nationalities and races that he uses in his books, does seem to be a little bit disappointing. Maybe it's intentional, maybe it's not, maybe it's just a cultural thing that I'm missing, or maybe it's just a standard, maybe it's just something he's not interested in looking at in his fiction, but it just seemed to be a bit weird that he's creating, like, I've read, like, four different worlds that he's created, and all of them seem to have exactly the same attitude towards women and gender. Yes, that's it. So, I'm going to skip across to my iTunes and look up all of the episodes so far of the SFBRP, and I'm going to sort by time. The shortest episode was Venus of Dreams by Pamela Sargent, 10 minutes 41 seconds. The longest episode so far of an actual book, a proper episode, was Arctic Rising by, oh, that was only a few episodes ago, 1 hour, 26 minutes. There's two longer episodes, Earth Abides, but that was a discussion with me and Jesse, and there's another episode where me and Jesse and other SFF audio people are discussing. They got into the feed. They're longer, but that's like a group discussion among lots of people. And here we are. Yeah, so as long as I finish this up within the next 30 seconds, I could... in the next 10 seconds, fuck, gone past the longest episode so far. Anyway, so as a conclusion, this book I thought was really good. It was a good page turner. It's very satisfying in, like, as I was reading it, it got a bit, it is redundant, massive parts of it are redundant. However, there was at no point in this book where I thought, hey, I'm not going to get to the end. And of a book this long, that's cool. I mean, that's good. That's pretty impressive. I was disappointed how the story, in fact, once I actually started it, I realized that the storylines weren't going to be the main focus, and it was going to be more kind of setting the scene, building the world, all that kind of stuff. So I'm not going to knock it for not having a strong story. However, the stories that were there, the endings were pretty good. The revelations at the end were pretty good. And I'm glad about that because, you know, it worked out. It was good. It was a successful novel on every level. And then when it comes to the point, is like, is this going to be like a massive epic series? I think if this book had been 800 pages long, loads more people would have been willing to read it, and it would have been a much, much, much stronger book. The stuff that was in the epilogue could have been hinted at and then used as the prologue for the next book. I don't think that needed to be in there. Just because that's in there won't make me read the next book anymore. I think having this book 300 pages shorter would have made me want to read the next book a whole lot more. You could cut out a lot of this stuff. However, on its own terms, as a book, which is self-admittedly an entrance into a 10-book series, and self-admittedly, I say self, like all, the author knows and is self-knowingly writing an epic monstrosity and is saying, you're going to read this book because you like big books with big worlds and big fantasy and lots of magic and lots of characters. I think at its own terms, it totally works. And as I was going into the book, it totally worked for me on that level. So if it was maybe 800 pages long, this would be, I reckon, a 4 or 4.5 story book, because then you could have got out the stuff that I don't like. But the point is, the things that I don't like in the book is obviously stuff that other people do like. So for all the things that I didn't like about this, which is the characters mumbling to themselves and Shallan's story and other bits and pieces, and I did enjoy the world building, I think you could have probably cut out some of the world building, not keep going on interludes around different places, not keep going here and there, and just have it a little bit more focused in at the start of it. I think that would have been the thing that would have pushed it up into a 4.5-star or 4-star book. For now, I'm going to give it 3.5 stars. I found it worth reading, but again, you've got to go into it. This is a big book. Don't say, oh, I started reading it and I got bored after 200 pages. 200 pages in this book. I actually made a note of this on goodreads.com. Let me skip across there. Is it here? Yeah. So I go, I was like, stop doing backstory. That should be out of the way in the first quarter of the book. Just get on with it. And then I said, oh, wait, I've still not reached the second quarter of the book yet. And that was after 293 pages. And I still wasn't quarter of the way through the book. So you've got to kind of, like, once you're a novel length into this, you've got to be thinking, ah, I'm still only quarter of the way through the book. So there's something to watch out for. Of a book this size. So 3.5 stars. That's all I'm going to say about the book, I think. Probably won't read the second book in the series. I'll probably check out other first books in big epic series to see which other ones I would ever want to spend time with. But yeah, see how it goes. See what the reviews are for the second book. Check out those 3-star reviews on Amazon.com. That's probably where you want to go. I flicked through some of the reviews on Amazon.com. Seems like I've got quite an average review. What else do I want to say? Yeah, you can check out all the books that I've reviewed so far on the website, sfbrp.com. You can check out episode lists and see all the books that I've reviewed so far as sorted by episode number and author, and as by star ratings as well. You can see where this book fits in with other books, which is pretty good, so check that out. You can email me, luke@juggler.net, if you've got any questions or suggestions or other book, anything else at all. You can get in contact with me that way. And if you want to read my novel series or any of my original fiction, you can check it out there on lukeburge.com, or email me if you want to check out the latest stuff, which I've not published yet onto my website, luke@juggler.net. You can email me too. And finally, check out goodreads.com. I post reviews there, and you can always see what I'm updating. And also, I really enjoy seeing what you guys have been reading. So here, if I go to the Way of Kings page, which I've got open in front of me now, I can see that readers of this book, friends review, 37 people have marked it as read, and there's a 4.5 average. So I guess the people who get into this book really do like, they know what they're getting into, they're a fan of Brandon Sanderson. So I do think this is skewed towards people. There's like a self-selecting group of people who are even going to pick up a book like this, and of course those people are going to enjoy it more. If it was a 300 page book, it would probably be rated a lot lower, but then if it was a 300 page book, I think it would be actually a lot better. On average, 4.57 books. This, again, is very, very highly rated by goodreads.com. But I do think that is, again, very, 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 very self-selecting. I can check out what you're reading. I can see what you're doing. You can follow updates of the books I'm getting to and reading next. I promise I will get onto the reviews that I was going to do of Dune and the last book in the Book of the New Sun, which I listened to on audiobook months ago now. But I might go back and listen to some bits and pieces of that again and record a review. I'll get onto that. So thanks a lot for sticking with me through the longest ever episode, longest ever normal episode of the Science Fiction Book Review podcast. Thanks a lot, and I'll catch you next time.